Today's date is Friday evening, November the 30th, 2012. Our study is entitled Peace and Presidential Election. What we're really doing is we're unlocking the testimony of Jesus and applying it in different dimensions so that we can fully comprehend and understand its import. You heard the date. If you're mindful of American history, you know that we've just had a presidential election. The world in its entirety was watching. On November the 6th, 2012, the long, hotly contested battle for the American presidency was won by Barack Obama. And by the way, you should know that the mustard seed did not advocate for or against him. Obama, the first African-American president, won a second term that day by resoundingly defeating his conservative Republican counterpart, Mitt Romney. And many, including the mustard seed, sighed a great sigh of relief. It truly, to all who observed it, was an historic event in world history. One that heaven had to have influenced, as indicated, among other things, by the ravages of Hurricane Sandy. As expressed before, Hurricane Sandy was quite appropriate because the Lord depicted that his church would be demolished when the winds came and the floods came, and the house that was built on the sand would fall, and great would be the fall of that house. Therefore, I think that it is of great historical significance that Hurricane Sandy had an influence in world events as the entire world sat and watched. Today, let us see more of heaven's perspective. And let's begin by turning to Psalms chapter 41. We're familiar with Psalms chapter 41. We're going to apply it now to the presidential election. It, again, I said, was historic. Let us read. Blessed is he that considereth the poor. The Lord will deliver him in a time of trouble. Please don't glibly let their words enter into one ear and leave another. There are some key words there that need your intense focus. We can't read this as we read it yesterday. We throw the word blessed around very cheaply, but the word has great meaning. It identifies some of the reasons why people supported Barack Obama and others, not warranting the Lord's blessing, supported Mitt Romney. But the text does not say, blessed is he that does not deficit spend. Blessed is he that doesn't balance the budget. Blessed is he that seeks to increase taxes. Neither does it say, blessed is he that enforces the U.S. Constitution, nor he that is not a Mason, nor he that has a valid birth certificate, not even he that resists gay rights. Those may or may not be legitimate reasons to elect a president. But you must know that it is God who gives the blessing, and he doles them to those who do what? Consider the poor. You need an example of this consideration. Examine the illustration that we see in John 6, where Jesus fed the 5,000. He did so, and he left the Father with the bill. That was one of the greatest episodes of deficit spending you'd ever see. He didn't have the coffers to buy. But what he did was consider the poor and the hungry. Some were content to just send them away. You can't send them away. They need to be fed. That type of thinking wins for you blessings. Now, this statement in Psalms chapter 41 has primary application to the mustard seed. But there is no reason why it could not be applicable, as we will see, to anybody that does what? That considers the poor. I say primary application to the mustard seed because the mustard seed is heaven's agent for health care, food stamps, and deficit spending. When the healing starts to take place, when the resurrections come, there's not going to be a bill that's going to be presented to the beneficiaries. Father has already paid the price. And he expects you to liberally dole out the benefits and the blessings. You can't do that if you take the Mitt Romney approach to well-being. That is, hoard what you've got and keep it from the poor. I found it remarkably appalling that the entire Republican nomination process that appointed Mitt Romney to represent them was engendered out of an anger, believe it or not, that Barack Obama increased the rolls of people on food stamps. How can you gin up anger for a man like that? And then have the nerve to say, God bless America. You don't understand theology, although you may be a part of the, quote, religious right. I tell you, as long as America is a force to relieve the impoverished. Now, you may not ever thought about this before. It's a keystone facet of our ministry that needs to be brought to the light. As long as America is a force to relieve human suffering, she will remain and reign preeminent in the earth. I can't believe there are organizations out there that has their rallying cry, death to America. Well, what you going to do the next time a tsunami hits your land? You know what I'm saying? Next time an earthquake strikes, you going to expect the Chinese to come? You going to expect the oil-rich nations of the world to assist you? These are the things that Father is concerned about. And therefore, until that nation, and she will do this, abandons her call to assist God in that regard. You know, Lord told us, he didn't say, my eye sees every sparrow of the fold. That wasn't Christ's testimony, it wasn't Jesus' testimony. It says what? God sees every sparrow that falls. And he says, human beings are worth more than many sparrows. Therefore, those of you who have made it your purpose, as the mustard seed has done, to meet the needs of the greater than the sparrow human beings, are those that can expect the blessing. I don't care whether you're a 33rd degree Mason, whether you're a member of the Illuminati, God doesn't care, and I'll show you this in a little while, you know, whether you're an advocate of gay rights. None of those things take preeminence so long as you assist him in his work. You do that, you're serving his purpose. That's what America's calling was for. So might as well make it plain, make it known today. In fact, let me take you on a brief excursion. I should say, quickly add, that the mustard seed doesn't advocate gay marriage or anything such as that, but it does advocate, as receives as its calling, a ministry expressly devoted to the poor. Well, you're going to find out why if you continue to listen to the study, but let me just take you on a quick excursion to Isaiah chapter 58. Isaiah chapter 58 is our rallying cry. In interrupting the fullness of that text, we're beginning in verse 6, and going through verse 10. Is not this the fast that I have chosen? To loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burden and to let the oppressed go free, and that ye break every yoke. That means even if there's an illegal alien hanging out in your neighborhood, the Lord doesn't call for you to increase his yoke, but to relieve it. Not just the yoke of African Americans, not just the yoke of Jerusalem, but every yoke. Is it not to deal thy bread to the hungry? To deal what? To deal thy bread. Lynette reminded me of what we did when we first got engaged. We became excellent bread makers in Bashan. We relieved Sister Jimmy Bingham, who was the vice president of that organization, of that duty. But every Wednesday, we made bread for everybody to eat. And that's the symbolic of our work. The Lord wanted the world to understand, and they will understand, that we distribute the bread that has come down from heaven. That's the testimony of Jesus. Is it not to deal thy bread to the hungry, and that thou bring the poor? Bring the who? Why would you bring the poor? Because you want the blessing. He didn't even say you got to love the poor, did he? All you got to do is say, huh, how are my policies going to affect the poor? That's what you would call consideration. He says, that thou bring the poor that are cast out to thine house. When thou seest the naked, that thou cover him, and that thou hide not thyself from thine own flesh. Unfortunately, Jerusalem has been made impoverished. Therefore, our first commission is to resurrect them. What's going to happen? We're going to receive a blessing, just as David promised. Then shall thy light break forth as the morning, and thy health shall spring forth speedily. Lord has got a health care bill as well. You have to merely tax yourself to this commission. That's what he's really telling you. It's not just the fast that I have chosen. A fast is a taxation of your own desires and wills. Just like if the government says, I want you to increase your taxes from 17% to 28%, that's an increase of your burden. Well, this is an increase of your burden as well. How you receive the blessing. Then shall thy light break forth as the morning, and thine health shall spring forth speedily, and thy righteousness shall go before thee, and the glory of the Lord shall be thy reward. Then shalt thou call, and the Lord shall answer, and thou shalt cry, and he shall say, Here I am. If thou take away from the midst of thee the yoke, and the putting forth of the finger, and speaking vanity, if thou draw out thy soul to the hungry, and satisfy the afflicted soul. Then shall thy light rise in obscurity, and thy darkness be as the noonday. This is our commission. Therefore, unlike Barack Obama, we take his message to a higher derivative. We're not trying to just cater to the quote-unquote middle class. We're trying to cater to the lower class. But I have to make the distinction. The election is over. Nobody can accuse me of being political. But the other candidate had a different commission. He never refuted these publicly in a way that was credible. I have to assume that the constant bombardment of these themes was correct. Would walk into plants that he purchased, call the people together and assure them that they would have their jobs, and then cut their pensions, lay them off, and sell the company for profit. Now, that may be good business practices, but it can't win you a blessing. You're creating poverty. This is why I say the mustard seed sighed a sigh of relief. Are we going to suffer under this type of excess? Thank God he hasn't forced us to so do. His claim to fame would be cutting food stamps. Tough love, you see. Somebody's hungry. Take away the benefits that they've gotten already. To force them to become your servant. To force them to become humiliated. Liquidate their pensions. Hoard the wealth. Dodge the taxes. Establish your income overseas So it's beyond the reach of the government's yearning to benefit through transfer payments those that are impoverished. Yeah, but suppose the poor people are always going to abuse benefits. That's what they do. In fact, that's one of the reasons we're going to see why they're poor. You have to leave that up to the Lord. Be as careful as you can in managing. Be as distrusting as you want, but you still have to at least consider the poor. I tell you, there's been no Bible blessing that I've ever been made aware of that was proclaimed for those whose mission it is to preserve the wealth of billionaires. That would be something, wouldn't it? Now, I know that the poor can be ungrateful, disrespectful. The reason why I know these things is because that's what you find out when you consider them. In fact, I can use my own children as an example. Did a lot of deficit spending for them. We borrowed money to feed, to house, to educate them. Yet it seems with no gratitude. When you understand the peace offering, you can't worry about those things. You need to know that Father is more concerned than are you about that type of demeanor. In fact, that will help you to understand the problem that He's dealt with for 6,000 years. He continuously helps people, and there is no gratitude or appreciation. It's up to the parents to find out a way to give an offering, a peace offering for the children. As we begin to explore and write and study more about this issue, you'll see that was the law. It was the thrust of the peace offering. Now, the children of Israel were required to deliver their own peace offering, but for the preservation and grace of the entire nation, the high priest was to offer a peace offering for Israel. It was an offering of thanksgiving. I'd like for you to examine that lesson as it's written in Scripture. The Lord knew that children are seldom appreciative and thankful. We're leaving Isaiah chapter 58 and we're moving to Leviticus chapter 7, verse 11 and 12. And this is the law of the sacrifice of peace offering. Now you know that you're elevated to be greatest in the kingdom by teaching and abiding in even the laws that are considered least. This has got to be one of them, because I don't recall anybody ever emphasizing the need for a peace offering. This is the law of the sacrifice of peace offering, which he shall offer unto the Lord. If he offer it for a thanksgiving, then he shall offer with the sacrifice of thanksgiving unleavened cakes mingled with oil, and unleavened wafers anointed with oil, and cakes mingled with oil of fine flour of rye. These peace offerings are really a gift to the Lord of bread, and that really symbolizes our work. But notice, it's the priest offering it for the children of Israel, the higher authority, the parent, the leaders making accommodations for the ingratitude of their children. It mentions bread. That makes my mind race to John chapter 6. Please turn there with me. Verse 26 and 27. Jesus answered them and said, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, ye seek me, not because ye saw the miracle, but because you did eat the loaves and were filled." Jesus blessed the loaves and distributed them, and the people enjoyed it. But he's telling you what we've learned in prior study, that those loaves have lost their efficacy. Therefore, he says, "Labor not for the meat which perisheth, but for that meat which endureth unto everlasting life, which the Son of Man shall give unto you. For him hath God the Father sealed." There is a meat that will yield everlasting life. That's what you need to work for and labor for. That is what's going to be distributed. And that's what will bring to you your light and your peace. That's the essence of the Mustard Seed Chronicle. The mustard seed, God's ordained vessel, has been inaugurated to deliver to you the bread that worketh and endureth unto everlasting life. Therefore, the mustard seed is the Lord's president-elect for that service. Don't expect Barack Obama to deliver it to you. But you know, it says meat. Even from that context, you see that meat refers to bread. The terms were interchangeable. We see that. I'm going to read to you Leviticus chapter 2, verse 1. It says, "And when any will offer a meat offering unto the Lord, his offering shall be of fine flour." The meat offering is a reference to the very bread which the Lord intended for us to labor for. For the past 2,000 years, we labored for the bread as it was distributed through Jesus' personal ministry. But the day is going to come when that bread will lose its efficacy. It perishes. It has no power. In fact, it could not deliver anybody who closely and carefully adhered to it to receive everlasting life. Life that lasts forever. Without the peace offering, what do you get? Put simply, you catch hell. And if that's what you're catching now, then you can rejoice, because the man who distributes the bread that Christ recommended to bring you your peace is on the scene. The mustard seed, this very ministry, is presenting to you this delicacy. We're talking about our need to consider the poor. I want to make sure that that point is well ingrained within you. Therefore, I'm going to refer you to Matthew chapter 25, verses 31 through 37. We saw in John 6, verse 27, that not Jesus, not Christ, but one whom he referred to as the Son of Man will have for you the meat which endureth unto everlasting life. We spent a great deal of time establishing the fact that this Son of Man is the one also described as Ezekiel and given the commission to blast his trumpet of warning, and that those who receive that message would receive life everlasting. We find that in Ezekiel 33. And likewise, he was referred to as the Son of Man. And now we see a revisitation of that same theme. Verse 31 says, "When the Son of Man shall come in his glory, and all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory." We could delve deeper into this study and show that this is the union, we'll call it the marriage, where Christ invisibly descends upon that prophet and a typical prophet called Ezekiel, the son of David, the one who does the will of the Father, the man. That's why he's referred to as the Son of Man. He embraces Christ, and we know that Christ told us in his ministry that he always does that which pleases the Father. That was the message that he intended for us to receive. We are to therefore reiterate his testimony that he gave 2,000 years as he spoke through Jesus, and we're to reiterate it, not proverbially this time, but plainly. That is the bread that endureth unto everlasting life. And now we see the Son of Man comes in his glory. Glory. We saw in John chapter 17, a text oft repeated, whereby the Lord prayed to the disciples that would come after the original 12, the disciples indeed, and he asked the Father to give to them the glory which the Father had given to Christ. John chapter 17. You need to hear that again. Verse 20, neither pray I for these alone, but for them also which shall believe on me through their word. He's praying not for the original 12, but those that would believe on him through his word. The mustard seed is the only one who defined the identity of Christ. Therefore, its adherents are the only ones that this could apply to. That they may be one, as our Father art in me, and I in thee, that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe. He has a ministry for the world, understand, that's to be directed through the mustard seed disciples, the disciples indeed. Therefore, the blessing is so that the world can believe. That the world may believe that thou hast sent me. The world doesn't believe that now. They believe that Jesus Christ was the Father. Therefore, he wasn't sent, but the Father came himself. We need to teach them that Christ was separate and distinct, that Father sent Christ. And the glory which thou gavest me, I have given them. Who did he give this glory to? Not to the original 12, but to those who would emerge in the last day to distribute this bread of life, this meat for the poor. He asked the Father, the glory which thou gavest me, I have given them, that they may be one, even as we are one. I in them. That means that, representing what we talked about last week, Emmanuel. Christ is not going to shine brightly as he did anciently. He's going to hide himself in them. I in them, and thou in me. Therefore, if we're united, beginning under the ministry of the Son of Man, we become one. That was what the Lord's Prayer proffered for us. And when that happens, God is with us. Who are you talking about when you say God? We're talking about the Father. Because he said, I in them, and thou in me. If Christ abides in us, and Father's in Christ, then we are indeed Emmanuel, God with us. Now we've learned that God is in the Son by virtue of his testimony. That's how we can make the distinction that the Father sent Christ. And we need to understand that as we explore the mission and the commission of the Son of Man. When the Son of Man shall come in his glory. Therefore, he's coming to mustard seed disciples, Emmanuelites, men who proclaim God is with us. Matthew 25, 31 through 37. And all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory. And before him shall gather all nations, and he shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divideth his sheep from the goats. And he shall set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left. Then shall the king say, he's speaking through the Son of David, the one who was promised eternal reign over his kingdom. That's what the king is going to say. That's what the Son of Man is going to proclaim. See, the Son of Man, you're going to find out, he's gathering the poor. His mission is to rescue the illegal aliens. See, I'm not just talking about the Mexicans. I'm talking about all the other aliens, Jerusalem, that they've outlawed, imprisoned, and shackled. Then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, come ye blessed of my Father. That takes us back to Psalm 41, doesn't it? Talking about a blessing. Come ye blessed of my Father. Inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was an hungered, and you gave me meat. Those that have considered the poor. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. Etc. Verse 37. Then shall the righteous answer him. You see, they're not called righteous because they've never committed sins. They're called righteous because they did the will of the Father. And now when they're brought into the kingdom, they're to learn how to escape the shackles of sin. Then shall the righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee an hungered, and fed thee? And the king, verse 40, shall answer and say unto them, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these my brethren, ye have done it unto me. I can't see how this text could be applicable to anybody who advocated for Mitt Romney. We've seen the coming of the Son of Man, and we've seen that he reaps the blessing and bestows it upon those who have, just as the David promised, considered the poor. Let's look at another example. Let me refer you to Matthew chapter 22. The text begins by showing the rejection of the gospel by the last church. We know it's the last church because these events that are described to come thereafter have never occurred before. Hence, a Laodicea boasting that she's the last church has to reap the consequences of this event that's described. It shows how the Lord sent a wedding invitation to them, and they rejected it. Verse 7 of Matthew chapter 22. But when the king heard thereof, he was wroth, and he sent forth his armies, and destroyed those murderers, and burned up their city. Then said he to his servants, The wedding is ready. What did he say? The wedding is ready, but they which were bidden were not worthy. He tells his servants, those that were bidden weren't worthy. Now, this king represents God with us. It represents Christ's manifestation of power as he clandestinely hides upon his servant. That was his prayer, that he would be in the end time disciples. Therefore, he bids his servants, Go ye therefore into the highways, and as many as ye shall find, bid to the marriage. So those servants went out into the highways and gathered together all as many as they found, both bad and good. And the wedding was furnished with guests. They brought both bad and good. I like the way that is stated, and I hope that it rings a special message in your ears. And when the king came in to see the guests, he saw there a man which had not on the wedding garment. And he said unto him, Friend, how camest thou in hither, not having a wedding garment? And he was speechless. Then said the king to the servants, Bind him hand and foot, and take him away, and cast him into outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. It's not our purpose today to focus more clearly on this, but we should identify the fact that the servants first proclaimed their gospel to his church, the people that were bidden. They were given the gospel call, the call to the kingdom. This not only represents Seventh-day Adventists, but the highest of the Adventists, those who had the kingdom message first, Davidian. And they rejected it. They became transformed into beastly men and rejected it. Thus, they are the ones that the Bible refers to as the murderers. The king represents Christ expressed through his united disciples. This is why we have the upper room experience. It's to bring us into community so Christ can dwell within us. The servants represent the 144,000. They are the ones that are going to go to the highways and the hedges to gather in all, both good and bad. The garment represents that garment that Jacob, the blessed of God, was promised. Jacob in Genesis 28, when he had that famous dream, remember the ladder descending from heaven to Bethel and angels traversing up and down. And Jacob was impressed. He said, if the Lord will do what? Keep me in the way that I go. And give me bread and clothing to wear. Then he, in essence, said, then shall the Lord be my God. And I will give him 1/10 of all that I have. Therefore, Jacobites are tithe payers. And not only that, they've made the Lord their God. We're the first ones in world history who have done that. Because we're the only ones who have identified the name of the Lord. We know Christ. And we embrace Him as our God. Not because we are polytheists, but we recognize that the message that Father has for us is vested in Christ. And we embrace that message. Therefore, those who do not accept the authority of Jacob, those who do not embrace the testimony of Jesus, are those who refuse the bread that Jacob petitioned and the garment that he was to wear. They cannot have eternal membership in the kingdom, whether they be good or bad. You could be bad, but once you've got the garment on, it has a transforming power. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. We should understand the bottom line. The salvation standard is not the escape from sin. Father's going to give you victory over sin. This was his prayer. And it's only going to happen when the world knows that Father sent Christ. If you don't embrace that, then you cannot receive the garment. And your faith cannot be made whole if, I'm sorry to say, you're not a tithe payer. And if you're not a peace offerer. How can we as mustard seed Adventists, upper tier mustard seed Adventists, ever think to teach the world to embrace Christ if we withhold our tithe and our offerings? It mentions good or bad. That draws my mind to a text that I want to cite to you now. Let's talk about Romans chapter 1. We will be able to get a window into how good and bad can be saved and receive everlasting life. Well, we know how that is. They consume the bread that the Son of Man distributes. Let's consider verses 27 through 32. And likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burn in their lusts one toward another, men with men, working that which is unseemly, and receiving in themselves that recompense of their error which was meet. And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind to do those things which are not convenient. Therefore, these are some bad people, right? But he's not through. There's other bad people as well. Being filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, debate, deceit, malignity, whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, despiteful, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, without understanding, covenant breakers, without natural affection, without what? Without natural affection, implacable, unmerciful, who, knowing the judgment of God, that they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them. Therefore, I don't celebrate anybody that advocates a gay marriage. But I don't exalt that sin as being any more odious than any of the other sins. It doesn't do any good if you've escaped that, but you're afflicted with covetousness, with fornication, with murder, and the like. Paul said that such people are worthy of death. It would be different if he said those who commit the one sin are worthy of death than resurrection than death 10 times. But they're all given the same penalty, death. The reason why they can't escape is because they can't be covered by the wedding garment until the Son of Man emerges. It's the judgment that determines your destiny. That's why in Romans chapter 2, verse 11, it says, let's read verse 11, then 12, for there is no respect of persons with God. And that's really reiterating the point. We never understood what that meant. But he doesn't acknowledge somebody that's unmerciful as being better than somebody that's implacable. Somebody without natural affection. Somebody that's a boaster. Somebody who's disobedient to parents. There's no respect of persons with God. For as many as have sinned without the law shall perish without the law. And as many as have sinned in the law shall be judged by the law. This is why we have the Day of Antitypical Atonement, because it makes sinners at one with God. It's the legal procedure to bring you into unity with God. That's awful important for us as disciples indeed to reflect upon, to understand, and I dare say to consider. But let me just ask you a question. Let's get basic and fundamental. We're getting involved in the depth of the scriptures, but now let's get simplistic. The question is, why should we care about the poor? What is the efficacy? See, I can understand the Mitt Romney position. Why should I care about my millions of dollars? Because you want to continue that power that money brings. That's easy to understand. It would be easy to facilitate a ministry that said, be sure that you protect the billions of the wealthy. But I want to know, why should I consider the poor? So you can be blessed. That's a good answer. David said in Psalm 41, our opening text, blessed is he that considereth the poor. And I know that text in its fullness applies to the mustard seed. But it's not exclusive to the mustard seed. That's why we saw in Matthew 25 that the righteous within the United States, where the nations have been gathered, are going to be called blessed. And they're going to get inheritance because they've ministered to the poor. Therefore, I cannot claim that blessing to myself. This is really the blessing of Abraham. The Bible started out talking about blessings. We just perverted the word and we use it for everything. But when the Bible talks about blessings, it's referring to those that are going to receive the blessing that the son of Abraham, David, I should say the son of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, David, today the mustard seed, is going to bestow upon the world. That's why Abraham in Genesis 18 has promised that his seed would bless the nation. Let us explain now why we should care about the poor. And first let me tell you, it says, blessed is he that considers the poor. That's different. It doesn't say he that loves the poor, at least in that text. You know, I told you the poor come with all type of problems. But the high first-tier disciples become like God. And they know how to understand and to accommodate for the ravages of inconsiderate, impoverished people who you spend your lifetime trying to help and trying to assist. We're commanded to love the disciples. And we're commanded to do this to impress the world. But I might remind you as well, Luke chapter 24, verse 44, Christ promised to us that he would fulfill all the promises conveyed upon him in the Psalms, one of which is the text of our focus, Psalm 41. Therefore, I'm glad now that we can open up the Word and understand what's the benefit of considering the poor. Consideration of the poor represents the unique love of the Father. And let me tell you and assure you that the Father is wise in His love. It's not displaced. He knows that there's a benefit in helping those that are poor. it allows for him to do what he yearns for most. And that's to have a large day of salvation. He can save the poor merely by his ingenious tactic of running the world by promoting a core of righteous people that embrace his testimony to oversee those that are impoverished. That's why we're told, the poor you'll have with you always. They will always need charity or consideration. You know, the Old Testament shows you there are going to be some folks that are going to be given the assignment of grave diggers. Not everybody in the kingdom is going to have the same rank. And this system can prevail as long as you have people that are unlike the conservatives that have dominated the other wing of the political party in this country, people that have consideration for the poor. And I need to really enforce to you today that you sit on the cabinet as a disciple of the mustard seed. I feel incumbent upon me and feel it's my duty to remind you that I set the political tones. Your political opinions should not diverge from mine because you sit on my cabinet. Consider yourself like the people that sit on Barack Obama's cabinet. And some of them might be knifing them in the back. I'm sure that they are. But we are a united core. You'll see the benefit of that. But those of you who are at odds with this, I received a discouraging word this week that my brother Edwin, a staunch Bashanite, was a Mitt Romney supporter. Can you imagine that? You know what I'm saying? And it shows you, it gives you a window into why this election has efficacy and significance. But the mustard seed is the political organization of the world. We have to march in unity. We have to be united. Therefore, our mission to consider the poor ought to be the centerpiece of our hearts because it increases Father's joy. He loves people, not just the rich. His formula to save the poor, as stated, is brilliant. He simply gives them rulers. And you and I are distinguished because we're part of his direct and immediate family. We're brethren to Christ. We're sons and daughters of God. Those who will work under our influence are always people that claim to be servants of God. And they will continue in that claim. But we have a special place and a special rank. And we will receive that added blessing because we are the first to advance this gospel. This law was given for our good. In fact, the entire law was given for our good. And you have poor people for one simple reason. They are people who ignored the law. And as a result, they heap hazard upon themselves. That's why they're poor. Let me give you an illustration of how that works. You're working on a roof, and you know that you should be tethered with a harness. You ignore that, and you fall off the roof. Does that mean because you've ignored the law that the other workers should not take time to assist you and to recover you? It's just that when they see you fall, they are reminded of the importance of abidance by the law. That is for your own good. When you're on the roof, brother, you can't take 3 steps. Just take 2 steps backwards. No, I'm going to take 3 steps. Well, the Lord is going to be there to pick you up through his servants. And this is why we ought to consider the poor. They will always provide benefits and wisdom and morals and lessons. Satan's strategy will never work, whereby people just completely depend upon God to rescue them in their recklessness. God has given you a mind to obey the law, if you can't appreciate it. Today, the law is going to be written in our hearts, so we're going to love and joy over it. I can appreciate working on a roof while wearing a harness. I can appreciate driving on the right side of the road. Some folks can't, though. And when disaster strikes, they will need us at Father's behest to assist them. There's so much poverty and heap. I've seen it in my own immediate family. Because people have ignored counsel. When you tell your daughters to preserve themselves and their virginity until marriage, you're telling them to avoid the risk of hazard so that they could have control. And some of them are going to ignore, a few of them are going to heed. And unfortunately, they are going to reap the results that are going to require, should they petition to us for it, our mercy and our assistance and our grace. But we need to, as we extend that grace to them, affirm with them their reconsecration to the principles of righteousness. In this sense, the rulers in the kingdom are like the tree of life. They're those who are promoted to pick up all who fall. They are for the healing of the nation. If you don't like that assignment, but it's your commission to hoard all your benefits to yourself, so that you could be an island unto yourself and look at those who are suffering and not extend any assistance to them, then this work is not for you. There's no kingdom blessing for you. The blessing only is extended to those that consider the poor. If Father didn't allow men to fall, there'd be no reward for those who do His will. Therefore, the impoverished express to the universe the hazard without facing eternal damnation. See, some people think that Father's only way to convince people to walk in righteousness is to burn some people forever. That's not His resolution. His resolution is that everybody can see you as an antithesis of good behavior. Therefore, we need to understand it is the hour of Father's judgment, not your own judgment. The people that He considers valuable, we need to, in fear of God, appreciate, even though we may not fully understand, that He is all wise. And His elect must pass the test of poverty. This is why I don't encourage people to play the lottery, even though I've slipped up and fallen and done that in time past. Vinette and I have done that. But now we fully appreciate the struggles that we went through to build this work so that it could be funded by people who embrace and appreciate the kingdom call. And if your finances are limited, then perhaps there's something that you need to be more considerate about. But I say that His elect have to pass this test of poverty. We're not people that run from poverty. We're people that run to it for assistance. The same as you would run to a comrade who has tripped up and fallen and needs your assistance. The recent election was a test of Christian character. It doesn't mean that Barack Obama was a bastion of righteousness, but it means that he trumpeted the message that would bless the earth and that would bless the world. And those Christian bastions that rejected his call were rejecting, as we've seen from the testimony of Jesus, the clarion call of Christianity. Speaking of test, turn with me, if you would, to Genesis chapter 22. Let me refer you to Abraham's test. I want to remind you now that in this scripture, his son Isaac was 12 years old. That means that Abraham, decades before, left his father's house in Ur because Christ promised him blessings. He married a beautiful wife, Sarah, as part of his blessings. He journeyed with his nephew, Lot, and was promised the land of Canaan. He was promised a son, and after much burden and travail, the Lord finally delivered His promise and gave to him Isaac. It was only after all that that he was tested. I say to you that it's important to understand that the people on the highest echelons of theology are going to receive the most strident test. Why do you suppose that is? Maybe we will uncover as we read verses 1 and 2 of Genesis 22. And it came to pass after these things that God did tempt Abraham and said unto him, Abraham, and he said, Behold, here am I. And he said, Take now thy son, thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee unto the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell thee of. Verse 11. Abraham took his son up there, and Isaac inquired. In verse 7 you'll see, Behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? Now, you're going to understand that the burnt offering was not only a function of the atonement, it's also a function of the peace offering as well. And then Abraham said, in verse 8, God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering. Verse 11, after Abraham raised his knife to slay his son, the Bible says the Lord stopped him. Why? What was the purpose of it all? Verse 11, and the angel of the Lord called unto him out of heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, Here am I. And he said, Lay not thy hand upon the lad, neither do thou anything unto him. For now I know that thou fearest God, seeing that thou hast not withheld thy son, thy only son, from me. And Abraham lifted up his eyes, and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram, and offered him up for a burnt offering in the stead of the son. We could get involved in a lot of theology of this. We could expand to show that this ram caught in the thickets by his horns means it was powerless. That shows the thicket that Jerusalem is entangled into. In the ghettos, in the prisons, in the slums. They're entangled. They've got no power. They're caught by their horns. And that is the burnt offering. The Bible even expressed they've been metaphorically burned for the peace of the nation. But the point that I want you to see today is that after all the blessings, there was some reason why the Lord still felt the need to test Abraham. It was a test of certification. It was a test to resolve argument. A test to pass a cross-examination. People in heaven, hell, and earth would always wonder, why was Abraham elected? Why was he chosen? And the Lord could point to Abraham's faithfulness. The man is the quintessential peace offerer. He was willing to give his most prized possession. He waited 100 years for a son. And he was willing to give him up. What is your gift for the Lord? What are you struggling against? What are you holding on to so that you can receive the blessing? I tell you, it's a test. And this makes me think of our calling as high theologians. I often refer to it mathematically by saying, this is the calculus of theology. And in calculus, you need to know to differentiate and to integrate equations. And one of the reasons why they do that is to test limits. You see an equation, you need to take it to the first derivative and the second derivative, and it will give you limits on the capabilities of the equation. This is what the Lord does. He proved that Abraham had no limits on his trust and his fear for God. There's nothing that he would not do. And this is why his children are to be blessed. Think of a bridge. I remember watching a historical program that showed you the beautiful bridge they built. It was under engineered because when the winds came, it started racking and shaking. And it crossed a span, this long span of an ocean, maybe a couple miles. And then, but it could not withstand the test of the winds, and it collapsed into the sea. When they design bridges, they hire engineers to do that. What they do is they determine the limits. What's the maximum possible load that could be on this bridge? Let's suppose that there's a caravan of trucks going in all directions with full loads. How much would that weigh? And what's required to support that? Then they have to determine what factor they're going to multiply that by to guarantee safety. If they determine that 100 fully loaded trucks will be on the bridge, multiply that by 2, and then build the bridge to that accommodation, and you have a firm foundation, if that's what the engineers deem. Well, the Lord's engineers in this kingdom, the brothers and sisters of the Lord, have to likewise be adjudicated for their limits. I have to confess to you, this is an hour of communion. So now the Lord has called me to reach back into my history. And it's amazing some of the things that I remember. As boys, 9 or 10 years old, the only night we were allowed up to watch television was Saturday night. And we watched all those horror pictures. Dracula, Frankenstein, the Wolfman. I don't know if some of you, it was called Children's Theater. And one of the statements that burned in my mind, I praise the Lord for it, because even though those statements pervade the dark underworld, it shows that we can borrow a theme from that to show the darkness of our hour that we live in. And we used to play around, and we used to love the Wolfman movies. And I don't know if it was Don Cheney or John Belugosi or Boris Karloff. One of those men played the Wolfman, and the statement was, even a man who is pure in heart and says his prayers by night may become a Wolfman when the Wolfbane blooms and the moon is full and bright. Some of y'all might remember that if you're honest enough to admit it. And the lesson that we can garner from that that's scripturally valid is that you don't know people until they've met the test. Back then, I think the person that was the Wolfman was a trusting gardener. But he could be a minister. Could be a doctor. Could be a teacher. Could even be a Davidian. And though they fit into the community, when the moon loomed large and bright, when it was full, they would transform themselves in this terrible beast-like monster and wreak havoc on people. Well, the moon is figurative of the spirit of prophecy. It reflects the Bible, which is prefigurative of the sun. You know, Isaiah chapter 30 tells us that in the last day, the moon is going to shine with the brightness of the sun. And the sun is going to intensify sevenfold. The moon comes out in darkness. And it's going to come out in darkness just before dawn, just before sunrise. Sunrise is the time when Christ rests upon his disciples and they broadcast his light into the world. But before that, we're enmeshed in darkness. And a lot of these people who we find to be respectable are now, with the intensification of the moon, beginning to show that they're beastly hearts. And this is why the Lord called them murderers. They're not joying over the moon. They're howling at it as if they were some vicious beast. I like reading Confederacy Trap. I'm reviewing Isaiah 11. And I like what it manifests. And there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. The rod represents Davidia. They grow out of the stem of Jesse, represents the Seventh-day Adventist Church. The people who've turned their back on this call, who are baying at the moon, so to speak. And the Lord says that branch is going to grow up out of his roots. But I like that reference because it tells you about the vicious beast. It tells you about the lion and the bear and the leopard and the wolf. They're going to turn into peaceable characters. And it says, a little child shall lead them. So this light has got the power to transform people into righteous people that are non-aggressive and non-determinate to attack God's people. It's this message that's going to shine and blaze as the light of day that's going to have this transforming power. But your Davidian brother who rejected this calling, you see, even though they may have yesterday been pure in heart and may have said their prayers at night, I've sat and studied with them in time past and I've saw their purity. They had a pure heart because their mission ordained by Christ was to purify the church or declare the message of the church's purification. But they needed to meet the test of truth. Would they, when they see it come, because their commission given by Ezekiel was to go and to declare the rod message to them, but they were commissioned not to become evil and rebellious like that rebellious house. When the light of truth comes, would they attack it and its purveyor with murderous rage, or would they joy in it? This is what the test has been designed to do. And it's no wonder that you're going to see people from Bashan supporting the antithesis of Christology, embracing a man whom they formerly identified as a cultist, a Mormon, somebody who's been exposed, who in their practice of higher levels of masonry, actually in their temple, baptized the dead. Spirits of people whom they've known and who passed, they baptized them. Therefore, they've invalidated God's law. They've taught, just as you could see by Mitt Romney's practice of deceit and persecution, they taught that you're not held bound to the law. That once you die, your spirit can come in the temple and be baptized into glory and into righteousness. Though they rejected that, they've turned, for whatever reason, against Barack Obama, a man renowned as a Christian, may not be the best practitioner of Christianity, but his commission, at least, was in harmony with the Christian clarion call. Your heart has lost its purity. You've become a man with a beastly heart. And therefore, you have exposed yourself by this election as being one that is murderous to Jesus. You have, like the Jews at Calvary, and I don't in no way compare Barack Obama to Jesus. I merely say that he carried Jesus' clarion call of mercy to the poor. But by supporting the other side, the one who proclaims himself at war against the impoverished, you're saying, crucify Jesus and set Barabbas free. This is why the Lord calls those people murderers. They have crucified the Lord afresh. They have become beggars at the brightness of the moon. The people who cannot receive the blessing of Abraham. But I thank God that mustard seed Adventists, the first year disciples, have passed the stress test. And I think it's amazing that as you consider Genesis, the text where we saw the blessing and the test of Abraham, it's a point worth noting now that the Lord even provided to Abraham with all his wealth. He provided for him the sacrifice. Abraham could have stayed at home and sacrificed hundreds of sheep and goats. Yet and still God gave those to him. That didn't meet the stress test. You too need to demonstrate before heaven and hell and earth that you're not going to withhold anything from the Lord. So you see that your election is also a test. It's expressed by the church's standard on the poor. But some think now, because the emphasis of late has been to ensure that people pay their tithe. And you may think, money, why is it always about money? I know that's what you're thinking, because that's what I used to hear in church, growing up as an Adventist, constantly passing the plate. The reason why we now understand that Father requires your money, your tithes, and your peace offering is simply because it's the thing that you most greatly love. It's the thing that you attach closest to your heart. He doesn't want your money. He gave you the money. Where do you think Abraham got his son from? Where do you think he got the ram caught in the thicket? The problem is, you're not willing to give God credit for those things, and you do not fear God. You fear poverty. You think that if you give up your money, you're not going to have peace. And that's the test of your fear and your trust in the Lord. You know, your tithe was purposed to be given so that there could be meat in the Lord's house. That's what it says in Malachi. Bring ye all the tithe into the storehouse, that there may be meat in my house. Now, that meat is not referring to flesh and blood. That meat is referring to the meat offering. That meat is referring to the bread which the Lord promised will be doled out and distributed by the Son of Man, who would give to you bread which endureth unto everlasting life, whom the Father has sealed. Therefore, by embracing this message, you are affording the opportunity for the Lord to distribute meat. He doesn't want the world to do this. The lottery can't help you. In fact, if you hit the lottery tomorrow for $1 million, you're going to hold on to that for your security, just like the pennies that you have now. And speaking of pennies, that's why the Lord referred to the widow's mite. Says she gave the most, because she gave all that she had. Of course she didn't give the most as you would think the most. She gave the most as the Father would think of most, because it's the only thing that she had. The Hebrew economy was different than ours. It was expressed by animals and sheep. That's why it's referred to as the Hebrew economy. The economy enveloped the realm of farm animals. But if you had enough farm animals, you could live a good life. And you could garner service and were willing by merely you giving to them a portion for their hire, they could become wealthy. We saw that with Jacob. Therefore, let it be understood that you needn't hold on to your money and then expect the Lord's peace. You need to invest in His kingdom with the understanding that the Lord will grow it for you. This is a message that the mustard seed has to deliver. The Lord wants to supply His house, and He wants to show the universe that His faithful servants, the one whom Christ prayed for, are the ones who have invested in the kingdom. That's why they're given heirship to the kingdom. That's why they inherit it. The Lord is going to reward you most blessedly. Therefore, our peace and our establishment is not in the U.S. presidential election. Our peace comes when we are gracious enough to receive the bread from the man whom the Father has sealed. He is the elect of God. And this is what we've learned today in our study, peace and presidential election. And with that, I bring the study to a close.